The Rosenbeck Museum and Library presents Sherlock Mondays, hosted by Edward G. Pettit.
Welcome to Sherlock Mondays. I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenbeck Museum and Library in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and we're going on a biblioventure through the stories of Sherlock Holmes. This is episode 17, The Adventure of Silver Blaze. And joining me as co-host is Monica Schmidt. Hi, Monica.
Hey, Ed. How are you doing tonight?
Good. We are both appropriately hat-wear tonight. This is one of the stories where he wears the cloth cap.
The cloth ear flap cap.
The ear stalker. And you've got a hat on too.
Yes, I'm rocking my Gorin Brothers flat cap today, just because I don't want the audience to see my hair today. It's a little messy. So,
and I recently saw you at the Baker Street Irregular weekend in New York City, where we all had a grand time.
That we did. It's among my favorite 5 days of the year, which I think I've stretched into six, and I think some people sometimes stretch into seven.
Well, I have. We'll talk about something about that in a few minutes before we get to the story, because what we do here on Sherlock Mondays is deduce, decipher, and dissect Arthur Conan Doyle's stories about the world's first consulting detective, Sherlock Holmes, and his able assistant, Dr. John Watson, in a kind of conversational annotation, and touch on other little Sherlockian things along the way, too. If you are watching live right now, I ask you to please like and subscribe to these videos, and also have fun in the live chat. If you're watching the recording, also, like and subscribe to the videos. Sherlock Monday is also an audio podcast. And thank you to all of our podcast listeners. If there's any new viewers out there right now or new listeners to the audio podcast, you can watch all the past episodes on our YouTube channel or listen to all the past podcasts, obviously. But we do a story a week, so don't feel like you have to catch up. Catch up all you want. Watch them all. That's great. Listen to them all. But really, it's one story. That's what you need to do for this week. Read a story, and we'll talk about it and join in the fun. I would also ask everyone to please consider making a donation to the Rosenbeck Museum and Library. If you've already donated or joined as a member, thank you so much. That's how we get to do this show, because of your support for the Rosenbeck. So if you've not already donated or become a member or can donate even more, I invite you to do so. And thank you. Before we start tonight, I got caught too, because we were chatting a little before the show and I didn't get my drink made. And
I apologize, Ed.
Oh no, I'm finishing up the drink right now.
Yes, finish it. I'm drinking sparkling water tonight. I will take ownership of this. I caught the Rona while we were or at least I was exposed to the Rona while we were in New York, and so I'm in recovery right now, and I didn't see clients. I saw everybody via telehealth. Do not worry, ethics. But this has the best camera setup as compared to my home office. So it's,
yes. You're there.
So I'm here. Plus, I can ice here.
The drink that I'm drinking tonight, definitely, and perhaps some of you, every episode we feature a Sherlock tale designed by our good friend and co-host, Mary El Caro. You can find the recipes in the YouTube description for the episode, and I send the recipe out via email every week if you're registered for the show. And you can register at the Sherlock Mondays homepage on rosenbeck.org. And tonight is The Dog in the Nighttime. And it's a take on the dark and stormy. It's gin and rum and ginger beer, some sugar, lime, some bitters in there. But I've never mixed gin and rum before. I don't think I've ever designed a cocktail with gin and rum. I've done either or, but I don't mix them. So it's delicious, and it's topped with ginger beer anyway. And so it's
I'm partial to gingers. longstanding joke is my husband, who doesn't have much left on top, but the little that he has left is still tinged ginger. So an on-running joke that my ginger is superior. So all the ginger things.
We were just in New York City having a grand old time, and one of the first things early on is the Arthur Conan Doyle Society meets at mm-hmm. Mysterious Bookshop and has a little horse race. And you were involved in this year. You had a horse running, but
people don't know
what the ACD Society is, of which I am also a member.
Okay. So the ACD Society, or Arthur Conan Doyle Society, so acdsociety.com, is an organization that celebrates the world of Arthur Conan Doyle. So as Sherlockians, we tend to be very narrowly focused on one particular area of Conan Doyle's writing, so the Sherlock Holmes stories, and anything that's relatively kind of adjacent to that. But Doyle was prolific. And there's so much out there that doesn't get attention or as much attention because of the fame of the detective. And so the ACD Society was founded in part to, shed a light on the rest of Arthur Conan Doyle's work and celebrate that as well. And this is the third year that they've done the annual Doylean Honors, which are in different categories regarding... basically excellence in either like fiction and poetry or the visual arts regarding Arthur Conan Doyle. So there's that. And then this is the second annual running of the Wessex Cup, which is the most madcap fun that one can have in a bookstore in 30 minutes. Essentially, it is a bracketed race between various horses. But oh man, I wish I would have brought my horse with me.
Yeah, I should
have thought of that. But it's basically a little wind up horse and jockey are on wheels, and basically you can set on a racetrack and they go head to head. To basically the finish line. And so it's a bracketed race, until there's a winner. I was the owner and trainer for the Spider. Basically it's my stable is Spider. And Peggy McFarland who lives in Toronto, who's lovely and amazing, and is actually the Sherlockian I want to be when I grow up. Peggy is wonderful and artistic and actually customizes each of these horses and jockeys. And so, because of my BSI investiture as Julia Stoner, Spider was decked out with a spider web motif as well as some snakes and a few other odds and ends, which was lovely, but I think it might have thrown off some of the balance because my horse basically bucked my jockey from the, from the get-go, from the starting gate. And now my horse is glue.
Yeah, your horse didn't...
did not perform, but, that is okay. It's not about the performance. It's about, of supporting a good organization.
It's a lot of fun, and I really enjoy it. And I put the ACD Society link in the chat there. Check it out. You can read about the Wessex Cup on there, that their version of the Wessex Cup. But there's also a real horse race. And something associated with the Silver Blaze race that you are involved with this year, especially because I think you're talking there. You're giving a
Sort of. So I should probably kind of go back here. There are multiple organizations, multiple Sherlock Holmes societies, including the Baker Street Irregulars, that run Silver Blaze races. It's basically going to a racetrack and kind of, setting a day at the races and then having a specific race or a horse designated as Silver Blaze for the race. However, there's the one that we're speaking of at this moment is the Chicago Silver Blaze Race.
Yes.
Which happens to be, I believe, the longest running, continually running Silver Blaze Race. There's one that's in Baltimore that's been running for many years. The one in Saratoga, which is kind of, BSI connected, it happens every several years. But the Chicago Silver Blaze Race has been going on, I believe, for over 50 years. It's the longest running of one of its kind. And this year, the Watsonians of Chicago are collaborating with the Tourists International of Chicago, which is one of the Sherlock Holmes societies, to do a Chicago weekend. So on Friday night, there's going to be the Tourists event, and I'm the speaker for that event. And then on Saturday, there's going to be the running of the Silver Blaze Race.
What's the date?
It is the last weekend in June. Give me 1 second. We are going to run. It would be the 28th of October. So the 28th of June as well as the 29th of June. Under normal circumstances, I'd be probably about 30 miles south of where I currently sit at Riverside, Iowa's Trek Fest, the future birthplace of Captain Kirk, which happens to occur that same weekend. But I'm giving up my other nerdy pursuit in order to support Chicago and the tourists. And I'm very excited for that.
In our chat, there's a Tourist International. You probably know who that is. And
oh, yeah, probably Rudy.
And it and says 65 this year.
Mm. Thank you. Oh, actually, probably Jonathan Schimberg. My apologies. Yeah, Jonathan is the gentleman who actually runs the tourists, and he's a rock star. But yeah, 65 years. See what I mean? Like, it's got history here, and I'm very excited to be a part of it.
They've put together a Facebook page for this year's program, and they've just started putting it together. And I shared that link, but as more info becomes available, we'll share that link on shows in the future. People from all over watching us tonight, too, Monica. Mm-hmm. Philly, obviously, Richmond. Oconomowoc, did I say
it? Yes, my Oconomowoc. There.
Is it Oconomowoc or
It is Oconomowoc.
It is Oconomowoc.
I'm native Cheddar, man. I'm from Milwaukee originally, and we'll just say is that never trust a Wisconsinite that can't pronounce Oconomowoc.
All right.
Or Ashwaubenon, or many of the other delightful native or cities that take their name from Native American phrases.
We've got Madison, Wisconsin, Washington, D.C., Beaufort, North Carolina, Southwest Michigan, Evanston, Wyoming, Haddonfield, Italy, Florida, Minnesota, New Zealand. So people from all over the world watching this show. So thank you all for watching the show. It is so much fun doing this. We should get to our story tonight.
Yes.
I have shared a PDF facsimile of The Adventure of Silver Blaze as it was originally published in December 1893 of the Strand magazine. You can download that on the Rosenbeck's Sherlock Mondays page. So that was December. The last story, Copper Beaches, was June. So the original Strand readers had to wait 6 months for a new Sherlock story. You guys only had to wait a week. They had to wait 6 months for one. And in that time, Doyle was very busy. He's writing lots of things. But he also made a trip to Norway with Jerome K. Mm-hmm. Jerome, famous author of Three Men in a Boat and an author I love, and has a book, Idle Thoughts of an Idle Fellow, in which the entire giant paragraph dedication is to his pipe. So I have to like this author a lot. And he's very funny. But he goes to Norway for recreational sports, which he loves. He actually starts skiing and loves it, and he's kind of introducing it to more people. He's using his little bit of fame at the time to introduce people to skiing. In September that year, a story by the name of Lot Number 249 is published in Harper's Magazine, a mummy story, which is a fantastic gothic horror story from Doyle. I mentioned it because there was recently a Mark Gatiss adaptation of it. And the Ghost
on the BBC.
Christmas.
Is it available for streaming here in America?
Only on BritBox.
There's
a nice little Sherlockian thing in there that I won't tell people what it is. Just watch it. October, mm-hmm. The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes is published, which is the first 12 stories from Scandal and from Scandal and Bohemia through Copper Beaches. It's published by George Nunes in the UK, who publishes The Strand, and Harper Brothers in the United States. I'll share the covers of these, and right here, this is the cover of the British Adventures.
Oh, yes.
And note too that he's got the Strand Library on the front, the Strand Library's on the side. So we know where these stories come from, people. And it has all of the Paget illustrations in it, all 104 illustrations.
Mm-hmm.
The US version looked like this, the cover.
Mm.
And it only has 16 illustrations. Is that correct? 16 illustrations.
Yeah, I think
it has
so.
This fascinating design on the cover with, it says Gordius Notice, and this is like the Gordian knot here. Here's the sword that will cut it. And mm-hmm. I started asking around about this because I hadn't noticed
I'm fascinated by it. I'm not going to lie. I've never seen an American first edition, let alone this image. And I wondered
if it was something that Harper Brothers had used on other books or not. It doesn't appear to be, and it really appears to be designed for this book. And it's this kind of crime and punishment thing going around. Here's a judge. Here's a Bobby. You see the Darbys here and the key. Mm-hmm. This is one of those neck things attached to two wrist, cuffs. I'm not sure what this is. It looks kind of like an alien from War of the Worlds, the tripods, but it's not. I'm pretty sure this is maybe something that goes around the neck. I don't know. I'll have to find out what this is.
Actually, that almost looks like keys on a key ring.
Is that all it is? And I'm thinking something even more. You're right. It is keys.
Yeah, it looks like keys on a key ring.
And here's one of those police lanterns. So, it's, and they use a similar emblem for the memoirs when they published that, but from what someone told me, there's some changes in it. So it looks like this is the way Harper had wanted to put it out, Adventures. And so Doyle is publishing away here, and his son, Kingsley, his first son, is born in November. He already has a daughter. Kingsley is born in November. But in August, it's interesting, in the Strand magazine, they don't have, the Sherlock stories are famous now. Doyle's getting very famous, becoming a well-known author. So they need some Doyle content. They're running some other detective and mystery stories in the issues. But in August, they publish a piece called A Day with Dr. Conan Doyle. And it is, it's like an interview profile that they talked to him. They visit his house. It has illustrations and photographs from his home, his wife, and his child at the time. It's actually fascinating because it's Doyle's kind of it's his first brush with fame, and the interviews of his first brush with fame, and he's talking about the Sherlock stories.
Mm-hmm.
As if he kind of likes them still.
They just made him famous.
As we've seen, he kind of falls out of love with this, Doyle's the Sherlock stories, because he wants to write other things. He's actually already falling out of love. He tried to kill him off already with Copper Beaches and then decided to keep it going. But he had this one quote here, which I thought was fascinating. I'll put this in the a link to the text for this here too it's already up there. He mentions that he's talking about Dr. Joseph Bell, and then there's a letter at the end of this piece from Bell about Doyle and Sherlock.
Mm-hmm.
But what Doyle says about Bell, this is how he describes Dr. Bell. He says, he was continually before me, his sharp, piercing gray eyes, eagle nose, and striking features. There he would sit in his chair with fingers together. He was very dexterous with his hands. And just look at the man or woman before him. He was most kind and painstaking with the students, a real good friend. And I know he bases Sherlock's abilities on Bell, but this also sounds like he's describing him too, right?
Yeah.
You know, the eagle nose, the, you know, the piercing eyes, sitting with his, you know, fingers together, which is a frequent Sherlock pose when he's talking, when he's listening to people. And and the kind and painstaking with students, a real good friend, something people forget that Sherlock is, and you realize when you do the stories, he's very compassionate. He's compassionate towards Watson. He's compassionate towards his clients, as long as he likes them. If they're going to be snooty, then he's off-putting with them. So, but I thought that was interesting. And that's in that piece as well. So I recommend people to read that little portrait of him right at the time that we're reading these stories.
Yeah.
The adventure comes out. This is Adventure 13. Oh, and even the cover of this issue is, I'll share that too. This is available on the PDF because if you remember, notice the top here, this is the double Christmas number. This is December. With a colored plate. So that's the that's one of the specialties. It's got a large colored plate. But it's a double Christmas number. It's about, I think each issue of the Strand was around 40-ish pages, and this one is it's not quite double that, but it's I think it's an extra 30 pages is what it is. It is. Oh, I'm sorry. No, it's 100. It's usually about 100, and this one's about 130 pages. I'm pretty sure that's the numbers. 100, and now it's 130. But in any case, the fact that this is the Christmas issue, there's no Christmas story in it for anybody thinking like that's what they meant. That's not always expected with a Christmas number of a magazine at the time. It usually just meant extra content. But for the Strand, what it meant, what they were doing was, they've got the return of Sherlock Holmes. They could have published this story at any time. They could have published it in August, I think, as early as August, and they have chosen not to. They're saving it for the Christmas issue. So that's the selling point for this issue. If you've been waiting for Sherlock since June, now in the new Christmas number.
Well, I mean, and I mean, you know, I kind of have to laugh a little bit as I'm thinking about the BBC's current custom of having Christmas specials for everything. Yeah. Just, you know, so Christmas tie-ins, says, you know, the person who thoroughly enjoyed the Doctor Who Christmas special. So.
Well, yeah, and I did too. I loved it, actually. Now, our days, like if you say Christmas, you feel like you have to tie the content in with actually actual holiday. That was not the case in the 19th century.
Fair point.
Just knew that, you know, they could do. I mean, sometimes it was a scary story people wanted at Christmas, especially in England. That's, you know, that's a Christmas kind of story. It's a Sherlock story is what you're getting people for Christmas. So I'm sure there was lots of huzzahing. That there was a new Sherlock Holmes story. And what a story it is, The Adventure of Silver Blaze.
This happens to be a great story. And also it has one of the most quoted lines in all of the canon. It's quoted in so many different contexts, you know, ranging from the law to there was a Broadway, or actually there was a book that was named after, after it, which then became a Broadway play. You know, I mean, it's everywhere.
It's such a great story. And it begins, and oddly enough, only it starts in dialogue, and it's just actually
like the rare.
third, It's only the third story so far that has started with someone speaking. Sherlock once, Watson once, and now this one. But both of those were kind of like a little like, I'm telling you something, and it's like a little paragraph of speech. This starts almost as if it's as if a conversation is going on. That's the first time.
Yeah, it's kind of we are busting in the middle of a conversation. Yeah. We're hitting the ground running. The action starts immediately, which is different, and I like it.
I am afraid, Watson, that I shall have to go, and you know, and we're going to Dartmoor, and this kind of usually you get the statement of the case first. And the reason why they would need to go somewhere. But here it's, you know, in media res almost.
Yes.
It is, Watson is right away, you know, not surprised because this extraordinary case that everybody has been talking about in England about the horse that's gone missing. And he's so happy that they're going to do something about it. I can't pass by that, you know, my companion had rambled about the room with his chin upon his chest and his brows knitted, charging and recharging his pipe with the strongest black tobacco, the notorious black shag, most likely that he's smoking. But this is what he does when he thinks. This is to think, you need to.
It's his version of meditation. You know, the smoking is the om. You know, it's his mantra.
And the every newspaper that every fresh newspaper that comes out is being sent up to him, which is a lot of people. Now you think like, oh, what's that like? Two papers a day. It's like 15 papers a day being published in multiple, you know, issues, and so they're, you know, dozens of issues are coming up to him this day here, so he can read all the news about this. Isn't this nice, too? What does he say? He says, Watson says, I should be most happy to go down with you if I should not be in the way.
Oh, yes. Watson's still soft-stepping the idea that Holmes might actually want him on a case.
Holmes says, you would confer a great favor upon me by coming, and then bring your excellent field glass. I don't know, maybe he just wants a good pair of binoculars. They're going to go. Watson was hoping for this, and they're going, and then they get on the train, and here's the description, and then I'll share one of the most famous pageant illustrations.
Well, one of my favorites.
It's our logo in it's in our logo for Sherlock Mondays. A first class carriage flying along en route for Exeter, while Sherlock Holmes, with his sharp, eager face framed in his ear flapped traveling cap, dipped rapidly into the bundle of fresh papers which he had procured at Paddington, and then he offers Watson the cigar case and then the picture.
Oh. Is, one of my favorites.
I mean, this Paget one is just so well known. It's frequently used as where you like we use it for our, you know, to make our logo out of. But here it is in the midst of the text. There they are.
Oh yes.
And note that they're in the smoking car. I have looked in vain. I keep looking for the smoking car when I get on the train, and I just can't seem to find it. I don't understand why. I guess I'm just not looking well enough for the smoking
car. So I was just going to say, sorry, Ed. I feel like I should cue that trombone.
Now it would be the no smoking car. I know.
All the non-smoking cars now.
So. But here they are in the chair. I like these little like side desks here that the chairs have. I don't think I've noticed. I know it's an armrest, but it looks like it's a flat surface that you can put things on.
Yeah, almost like what they have like in like little university desks or whatnot. You know,
yeah,
some surface. I like that.
Watson with a cigar and Holmes, you know, explaining the case to him with his hands pointing out the different points that he'll do in just a moment. And then this is obviously the Deerstalker. So the passage says the cloth traveling cap with ear flaps, which, you know, maybe Paget gave him the idea to push that further, because you remember in the, what's the story that it's in? Boscombe Valley Mystery.
Yeah, Boscombe.
He wears the cloth traveling cap, and Paget then draws what we call a deer stalker, and but it doesn't necessarily say it's this hat. And now Doyle has described it even further to match this hat. So perhaps he was even influenced by Paget's illustration of it earlier.
It, I mean, you know, stranger things have happened. Plus, I mean, you know, this is where sometimes we'll just say there's that interplay between illustrator and author. I mean, we'll just say there's a lot of that goes on with Doyle, where Doyle is inspired by something that someone else creates and then kind of incorporates that into, you know, into the stories. This is why we have Billy the Page Boy later on.
Yeah. And it's also, as we mentioned in the last story, the Boscombe Valley thing. This is the hat you wear out into the country.
Exactly. So it's either this hat or that hat.
All the Sherlock stories where they're set in the city and the movies and TV, where he puts on, that they wouldn't have worn that in the city. So it's not a city hat. It's country hat right here. It's my country mode. That's what I'm wearing today. I'm in the country today with Sherlock. Also, I got to share that image again, because, what's fascinating is, and in the other pictures you can see it as well, it's a hoodie. This cloak that he's wearing, this long coat, has a hood that he could then put up. So it's a Sherlock hoodie, which I don't think I ever really put together that it was a hoodie.
You can see it. Yeah, I was lucky enough. Actually, there was a couple of years ago, there was an exhibit at the Grolier of Glenn Marenker's personal Sherlock Holmes collection, and that illustration is among them, and it is striking in real life.
Here it is. You can really see the hoodie here.
Yep.
So that's what he's wearing. All the illustrations in this story are fantastically detailed and really, really well done. Even to the point where, like, I saw this guy in the background of this illustration here when they're at the train station. They meet Ross and Gregory. I know we're jumping ahead here. Mm-hmm. But there's just this train porter behind him here with a little hand cart to carry people's luggage.
It's so detailed.
I look back
the expression on the guy's face.
I look back through all the other illustrations, and I think I found one other illustration where he will have like a background character who's not associated with the story at all. And this is a rare thing. And this kind of, it's just a level of detail that he's into. Maybe he just had a few months off and now he's just going for broke and really, but I found the level of detail in the faces, the expressions, the clothing, everything in this particular issue started to be a step ahead of what we've, a step more in depth than what we've seen for the illustrations and the other stories so far.
Yep. No, I love it. I love it.
Well, they're still on the train.
Yes.
Right. And Holmes has to, I like this because instead of his usual Dr. Bell trick that he pulls either on Watson or the client, here it's just a simple, I see we're traveling at 53 and a half miles an hour. And Watson says, I hadn't observed the quarter mile posts. And then Holmes is like, no, I haven't, but it's the telegraph posts, and I did the calculation. I read it was in the Les Klinger one that gets a pretty accurate, it's a pretty accurate estimation too of how fast they would have been traveling. Holmes has it right here. He understands
how
to do this. Doyle understood how to do this.
Well, I mean, considering how many trains the fella took, and the amount of time that he probably had to waste on those trains, a man like Doyle would do those calculations.
Well, he mentions the murder that has happened. He tells Watson now it was John Straker who was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Trainer, the horse, and the horse, Silver Blaze, has disappeared. He says, for Holmes, it's hard to make out the case, he says, from the newspapers. And he needs to see the details in order to deduce. He says, suffering from a plethora of surmise, conjecture, and hypothesis, the difficulty is to detach the framework of fact, of absolute, undeniable fact from the embellishments of theorists and reporters. And and then to see what inferences may be drawn and which are the special points upon which the whole mystery turns. And I've kind of summed this up as, in order to deduce, he needs facts, and then he'll make inferences, and then figure out the special points, and then boom.
But I mean, you know, that it shows that even then news reporting wasn't quite news reporting, that there was a lot of conjecture, commentary, in there. And, makes me yearn for Edward R. Murrow and, Uncle Walter Cronkite. But, this is the type of news that we have now. This is the type of news they had then, you know, rife with commentary and lacking complete facts.
He tells Watson that he has made a blunder. What does he say exactly?
That he made a blunder, that he couldn't believe that it's possible that the most remarkable horse in England could have remained concealed. Basically everybody knows this horse. So, I mean, it would be, oh gosh, what animal do we know? It would be like Lassie, somebody mistaking.
Nobody knows Lassie anymore.
I'm old some days, but, I don't know what we would have in the modern era, but
it would be, somebody would find this horse,
distinctive horse.
And so Holmes has wasted 2 days. He thought somebody's going to come when he first sees her. He's like, well, somebody will see the horse and turn it in, or nobody's going to be able to move this horse anywhere. And so he waits 2 days and nothing happens. And that's why he was so upset to begin with. But it's an acknowledgement that Holmes has begun this investigation by messing it up, because he wasted 2 days. This was going on. And that's one of the reasons he has to get down there to see the scene. And he then enumerates all. Now we get Holmes instead of the usual client, Kirk Cross, telling what has happened. And he goes through all the facts with Watson as if, as the client usually would. And it's Silver Blaze was the favorite of this race, so people didn't want him in the race. So there was a motive to get Silver Blaze. If people notice that he, when he's describing Silver Blaze, he said he's from Isonomy stock, Isonomy. Isonomy was an actual famous racehorse at the time that Doyle is inserted in there. Like, he is one of the horses descended from that horse.
And again, Doyle putting kind of, again, setting the story in, the real world, just trying to once again triangulate things in order to lend credibility to his stories and again blur that line between fantasy and fiction, or fantasy and reality.
And he's also creating a fair play mystery here. He's giving, through Sherlock is giving us the setup. He's giving us the clues, and then we'll get more clues just as Sherlock gets them, so we can follow along and see if perhaps we could solve this story. I mean, I don't know at what point that becomes a thing for mystery readers. I think it doesn't happen until more the turn of the century, but we see that seeds being set for that here, is that, an author laying out things that you could perhaps put together yourself and figure out the crime along with the detective. One of the things he mentioned, just the details that he mentions here that'll wind up being, clues for people. It's that the maid brings the food, and it's a dish of curried mutton. Holmes already knows that specific dish that is given to them. He tells how Fitzroy Simpson comes looking for a tip from the stable hand and doesn't, get one. And he is the one that has been arrested now.
He looks suspicious.
he runs away when they go, when they say they're getting the dog, and then he runs away. So yeah, it's the first mention of the dog that will come up. And Straker leaves during the night. The hunt, one of the stable hands, Hunter, is drugged. The horse is gone. You know, Straker's found with a thigh wound. He's holding a bloody knife, and he's holding the cravat for Fitzroy Simpson, which will, you know, implicate him.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of finishes all of this up with the mention that Inspector Gregory, well, maybe, I don't know if he finishes it up, but Inspector Gregory is on the case.
Yes. Inspector Gregory.
And this is his first story. I looked it up, and I thought, like, I may have seen it before, yep, but not. This is his first time, that, and I think the only time, that Inspector.
Well, it's Gregory, and then you were probably in your head confabulating him with Greg's son.
Ah, Greg's son. That's why I was thinking.
Because, you know, it's from, from Sign of Four, when Gregson or Lestrade, Anthony Jones are on the case. Essentially. So, yeah. But yeah, Gregory, this is, I think, his one and only appearance. But he's at least, at the very least, Holmes thinks that he's extremely competent. And so that in itself is an improvement.
Extremely competent, but were he but gifted with imagination,
yeah,
he might rise.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the thing that Holmes is awful saying. And we'll see that. And then it'll get reinforced later. He'll reinforce it with Watson and how Gregory couldn't figure this out because he just looks what's in front of him and doesn't use his imagination.
Doesn't imagine what could be or what might be as compared to what he just sees.
And after he gives Watson this whole, you know, rundown of the case, Watson has a question, which I love. Holmes asks for Watson's opinion, first of all. There you have it all in a nutshell, Watson. And if you can give me any light, I shall be infinitely obliged to you.
Oh, yes.
And Watson has one. And Watson does have a question. Do you have that there?
Oh, is it not possible? I suggested that the incised wound upon Straker may have been caused by his own knife in the convulsive struggles in which follow any brain injury. I mean, valid question. Very good medical question. Thank you, Holmes, for using Watson for medical reasons.
Yes. And it's all, but it also gets like Watson, like it might not have happened that way, but just the fact that he could have wounded himself. He has a thigh wound. There is a bloody knife. This might not be someone who's wounded him in a fight. This is, you know, so they don't have to necessarily look for somebody who's been wounded by Straker's knife. Straker may have just wounded himself with that.
Exactly. Yeah. If you pull out a knife, and as someone who tends to carry, if you pull out a knife, you know, you're likely to be stabbed by it yourself, you know, so you have to be very skilled with it. And, that's always been the, kind of the philosophy that I've taken is, am I prepared to be sliced by my own weapon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it is, Holmes says it's more than possible. It is probable. So he agrees with this right away. And I like this kind of, he loves bouncing things off Watson. He did this in The Man with the Twisted Lip too, where he's like, let me tell you the whole thing here. And then what do you think? And Watson make a couple comments, and they might not necessarily solve it like they're not going to, but it does get Sherlock to think about certain points and further him along, and he recognizes
and that's exactly Watson's purpose is to be able to to do that. This is actually one of the reasons why I, as a therapist, consult my colleagues. If I have a conundrum with a case, I always ask my colleagues, because they may not necessarily know the right answer because they don't know the client to the degree that I know them, but they often have some really interesting insights and perspectives that maybe I didn't consider.
Mm-hmm. They get to the train station, and they're met by a tall, fair man with lion-like hair and beard and curiously penetrating light blue eyes. And this is Gregory, Inspector Gregory. And then a small, alert person, very neat and dapper, in a frock coat and gaiters with trim little side whiskers and an eyeglass. Mm-hmm. And that's Colonel Ross, the well-known sportsman that Holmes doesn't take a liking to right off the bat. But they've met him there. Gregory's got him. Gregory's on top of it. He's like, okay, here's the carriage. Let's go. I'll take you right to the, you know, the scene of the crime, right to the stables and the scene of the crime, so you can look at everything here. Mm-hmm. Holmes has a series of questions. Well, Gregory first thinks that it must be Simpson, and you know, mm-hmm. and this is why. But then Holmes kind of has a series of questions that Holmes agrees, and he's like, "Yeah, I think you're right, but of course, a clever counsel will tear it all to rags." You know, mm-hmm. Why would he take the horse out of the stable if he wished to injure it? Why would he not do it there? What has a duplicate key been found? Who sold him the opium? Yeah. You know, the whole, everything that, you know, is here is, you know, they have no answers for.
It's circumstantial evidence.
Circumstantial. And we know how Holmes feels about circumstantial evidence, which is, forget the story that he starts talking. It's at Boscombe Valley. It is. It's Boscombe Valley where he talks about, you can't rely on circumstantial evidence. Somebody can correct me on that if I am wrong.
Well, you know, that's what the group chat is for on the feed. So
Sherlockians are for. So let me tell
There's
you.
That too. we are very good at that.
Well, I love it. And Gregory also tells him a new element has been introduced into the case, and that there's a group of Romani people in the area. They always get blamed. They're in always the area. And they must. Romani. They must be involved somehow, they're searching. You know, they're searching for them now. So, they're, because they were encamped on a Monday night within a mile of the spot where the murder took place.
Therefore, they must be involved.
Yeah. So that's his new, you know, his, you know, kind of new development, but they reach the stables, and it says, we all sprang out, with the exception of Holmes, who continued to lean back with his eyes fixed upon the sky in front of him, entirely absorbed in his own thoughts. It was only when I touched his arm that he roused himself with a violent start and stepped out of the carriage. And then he says, I was daydreaming, but Watson says, there was a gleam in his eyes and a suppressed excitement in his manner, which convinced me, used as I was to his ways, that his hand was upon a clue, though I could not imagine where he had found it.
Yes.
He's figured, I mean, we'll find out later. It's the, this is the moment when he thinks the curried mutton. Wait, curried mutton?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that's specific detail he knows is important at this point because it's needed for the opium. Disguise the opium. And
exactly.
Now that he's got something, one of these kind of, you know, special facts that could lead to something, now mm-hmm. he wants to go. And the first thing he wants to do is look at the contents of Straker's pockets to see what other facts, inferences, special points he can find. And we're all, as you know, readers of mysteries now, this is where we're looking at the clues. And before we get to the clues, let me take this moment to thank all of you for watching this episode. As a nonprofit organization, the Rosenbeck Museum and Library depends on the generosity of friends and supporters like you to keep this program free and accessible to hundreds of fellow Sherlockians worldwide. I hope you will consider supporting the Rosenbeck and Sherlock Mondays by donation, which you can do so at our website, or by becoming a member. Membership gives you free museum admission, discounts on programs and courses, and exclusive invitations to member-only events. You can learn more about how to become a member on our website. Part of our membership is early access to programs and course registrations. We've got a bunch of lots of great in-person and online programs and courses coming up. You can find them at our website. And the courses are really great. Monica, I'm teaching a course on Dracula using our great, you know, Bram Stoker notes for Dracula and our Dracula collection. That's an online course that is just about full. So if you want to take a course that I will lead You better register soon. There's also a weekly Ulysses Weekly with Robert Barry, who's a great illustrator of Ulysses, been illustrating it for years in comic book form, and he also teaches Ulysses at University of Penn, mm-hmm. and on his own, and on he's done several courses for us at the Rosenbach. It's going to be a great course for the book. You always said, like, oh yeah, I'll read Ulysses one of these days. This is how you read it, with a group of people together that meet frequently and also connected to a place that has the complete manuscript of Ulysses. So this is your, this is the way you read it. You'll finish it before Bloomsday on June 16th, and then you can celebrate Bloomsday with us. And if you take the course and you're in the Philadelphia area, you get to read at Bloomsday on June 16th for the Rosenbach. And our big day-long festival. A lot of fun. There's a Robert Burns course coming up. There's a Virginia Woolf course that is just about full. I think it's got two slots left in it. So lots of great stuff. Check us out online. Engage in other programs with us, other paid programs, and see what we have to offer for you. You can also join the Facebook group page, Sherlock Mondays, where we post lots of, you know, news and links and conversation and fun. I just put up a bunch of pictures that I took, or pictures of people and me at the last BSI weekend, where we have an audio podcast version of the show. Look for the Rosenbach podcast, Sherlock Mondays, wherever you get your podcasts. They drop one a week after the video ones. You can always write to me at epettit@rosenbach.org, E-P-E-T-T-I-T at rosenbach.org. I love to hear from you guys, who many of you write to me. People are still asking about Sherlock Money's merchandise. It is coming. We had to change our whole process of how we do things and the show, and it's fine, but it's just that it's taken me longer to put it all together. So, but it's going to come together, you know. And there will be Sherlock Mondays, you know, t-shirts, glasses, stickers, things like that.
Because I need more glassware.
Yes, you do. And there will be a Hound of the Baskervilles show when Sherlock Mondays ends. It is going to be a pay-only show. So, and we will work through Hound of the Baskervilles in 8 episodes with all of the same co-hosts in the Mondays in May and June. The registration will get posted soon. Just doing the final details on that, and then that will be available for you to register. And I hope you will all come on that little biblio venture with me as well. All right. Back to the story. The contents of Straker's pockets. You know I have to talk about.
Of course. Go ahead.
An ADP briar root pipe.
Mm-hmm.
And a pouch of seal skin with 1/2 ounce of long cut Cavendish and a bunch of other stuff. I just stopped right there. Like, ooh, wait, he's got a pipe and tobacco. What's all about? The ADP
briar, baby.
Yeah, and it's a briar pipe, and briar is the most common pipe. Briar root, best briar root, generally comes from France, actually. Several places will tell you they have the best. I think the St. Claude Briar is though well thought of. But ADP, there's lots of, let's just say that a few companies have been proposed of what Doyle was actually meaning, if he was actually really meaning an actual pipe company, but we don't really know. It could fit a few different ones, but none of them exactly. Like there was no known ADP pipe that is actually this kind of pipe. No, it's just there. You can find some pipe companies where those initials work in some way. And the Cavendish is a type of tobacco that, well, it winds up being a confusing term now. There was a, Cavendish is actually a process of curing the tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, it was with rum in the 17th century, and then they would roll it, and then they would cut it into slices. Now, it's basically, you kind of add sugar to it, and it's heat and steam pressure, and then you cut it up, and that's mm-hmm. how you get Cavendish. So it's a sweet-flavored tobacco, but mm-hmm. now companies just kind of call Cavendish for anything kind of sweet flavor. They don't even worry about the cut or the way it was cured. sometimes they actually add flavorings to a kind of a sweet tobacco after they've done this Cavendish process to it. But that's what Cavendish tobacco is. I know. Everybody's like, thanks, Ed. That was, you know, more than
it's helpful just because, you know, we do need to know these things. I mean, you know, it's actually important within the context of the story and, you know, and this universe. Plus, I mean, you know, who knows? We could someday this may come in handy at a trivia contest.
Yes. So, there are other things that he has, though, that don't have to do. We know what John Straker smoked, but what else do we find out? And one of the things he has is this little knife.
Ooh, yes.
A very singular knife. And Watson, this knife is surely in your line.
Oh, yes. That's what we call a cataract knife.
Yeah. And Watson tells him what it is. He gets to use his medical knowledge to identify the cataract knife, which I like a lot, that Watson's again in this investigation.
I'm loving that he's finally using Watson, his medical friend, as a medical reference.
What happens in the very beginning, does he ask him, he doesn't ask him anything in studying Scarlet, but he certainly doesn't sign a four when he asks him to, you know, look at the body and
oh, yeah.
See how then and confirm that
he just doesn't happen very often. Yeah. So I rejoice when it happens.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, I mean, well, what we are dealing with, Nigel Bruce, you know, like I'm responding, I think, emotionally because of the Nigel Bruce-ness. And I know I have a friend of mine who's an ardent defender of Nigel Bruce's Watson, but because Watson was kind of Bubus Britannicus, or at least portrayed in that way, it's always nice when it's like, no, Watson was a medical man. He was a man of intelligence.
Yeah.
Look, he does things. He knows things. He's useful.
Yes. But much like Inspector Gregory or some of the other police, that he lacks that imagination. He can't make that leap, that inferential leap that Holmes does
exactly.
in the stories. So there we go. There's also a receipt in Straker's pockets, and it was from a milliner's for a William Derbyshire. And for 20 guineas... account for £37.15 made out by Madame Le Sourier of Bond Street for a dress. So 20 guineas is rather heavy for a single costume, Holmes remarks. So, and why does he have a receipt for this without his name on it in his pocket? Mrs. Straker says that Derbyshire was a friend of her husband, so sometimes his letters were addressed here. Sometimes they got letters addressed to someone else, and he was like, oh, that's my friend. That's for me. Don't worry. Man, poor Mrs. Straker didn't put that together, right?
Mm-hmm.
Holmes, before he leaves, tests this out, and he asks, Mrs. Straker, surely I met you in Plymouth at a garden party some little time ago. You're mistaken. Oh, no, you were wearing that dove-colored silk. And she's like, no, I never had that kind of dress. So Holmes is confirming that this dress wasn't made for her.
Yes.
This will put him on the right track. He's already putting together. He's already correctly read this clue and found the motive for Straker without telling us.
Oh, yes. Naughty.
Without telling them either.
Yes. Never keep if you're going to do bad, never keep your receipts that you're doing bad.
I kept the receipt. Well, he had a story to back it up. He's a friend of mine. He said, I give it to him. So
what's that strawberries and champagne for? Oh, that's for a friend of mine.
All right, now they go out to the scene of the crime. Where the body was found, and Gregory knows how to treat a crime scene. Usually Holmes is complaining about everybody trampling over the crime scene before he gets there, but Gregory's had the mat laid out that everybody will stand on and look, and he's thoroughly investigated, and Holmes is impressed with that. except Holmes still finds, oh, even has one of the boots with Straker wore. He's got a cast of the horseshoe from Silver Blaze.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
But Holmes finds a wax Vesta half burned.
Yes.
And Gregory's upset that he didn't find it, but Holmes says, I was looking for it. So, you know, you expected mm-hmm. me. I only saw it because I was looking for it. For those who might not know, a wax Vesta is a match. That's mm-hmm. what it is. I used to use only Swan Vestas as matches when I smoked my pipes for many years. Mm-hmm. And then I think they became unavailable where I was getting them, and I never kept up getting them. You can still get them. I think they might be expensive in America. They come from England. But a wax Vesta was what... It was generally a little piece of wood, but it was heavily waxed.
Oh, interesting.
And the lighted and matches were called Vestas. This goes back to the Roman goddess of the hearth. The home fire was Vesta. And the kind of word kind of gets connected with fire, and it becomes the little match.
Well, you know, Kleenex gets generalized and
and people don't know that Kleenex was the Roman goddess of
facial tissue.
Yes, of runny noses. And now we call that. How about that? Well, Holmes finds this, and then they're like, okay, well, let's go back and talk. And he's like, I think I'm gonna go for a little walk.
Gonna look at some clues. Gonna ponder some things.
So, and I'll take the horseshoe for good luck. I'll put that in my pocket. Doesn't want to tell them what he's doing. He wants to go off and look at something without them knowing he's looking at it. We'll see this frequently. When he goes out in disguise, he leaves Watson at home. A little later in the story, he'll leave Watson while he goes and talks to Silas Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Holmes prefers to go off by himself to do all that. I mean, if he could have no one there, I'm sure he would like that. Anyway, he likes to do his investigating by himself. It's good to have Watson here to ask some questions for, to run things, you know, by him, maybe other people to answer questions or show him things. But he really does like to be on his own when he investigates. Yeah. Doesn't want the interference of Colonel Ross with his monocle looking like the Monopoly millionaire guy.
I love it. Actually, the Monopoly guy, by the way, does not have a monocle.
Oh, he doesn't?
No.
I think that.
Yeah, well, actually, Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, you must be the Monopoly. I think that's the reason at this point. But it's
interesting.
No, but if we're thinking about things, you know, I mean, it's easier to investigate and move as a single entity versus as a duo. And so leaving Watson behind on things where Holmes, we'll just say speed and stealth might be the most necessary, would make sense. I know I travel a heck of a lot faster by myself than I do with someone else, but I also prefer to travel, you know, with a companion just because of safety and, someone to share the adventure with and such. But there are times that it's advantageous to be solo. So mm-hmm. I can appreciate why Holmes would choose to ditch Watson briefly.
Well, at first he doesn't, because they're just following the tracks. And yeah. Holmes, and this is where Holmes kind of demonstrates that, you know, that he says, we're looking for a horse. So the horse is going to go somewhere. So let's go find out where the horse went and mm-hmm. find the tracks. And that's what they do. And this is why this is what Gregory doesn't do, that he only sees what's in front of him. He lacks mm-hmm. the imagination to go look beyond. It is the one quality which Gregory lacks, Holmes says. We imagined what might have happened, acted upon the supposition, and find ourselves justified. Let us proceed. I like how he weed all that. Like me and Watson figured out. We imagined. No, Holmes imagined it. Watson's just along for the ride. He brought him in.
Well, but Watson was useful.
Brought him in. He brought him into this. That was nice. The tracks lead back to Capleton. Which I recently discovered in some editions, it's Mapleton.
That's the one that I'm looking at right now is Mapleton.
Yeah, and it's actually Capleton in the Strand, and for some, or no, it was Mapleton in the Strand, but it's actually Capleton, and it was published as a book form in America because, and I don't know if there is a manuscript of Silver Blaze somewhere that can be consulted for that, the text, I think Capleton is accepted, Capleton with a C, but I don't, I can't tell you why it's accepted. I can't tell you the authority of that. Well, that's where the stables are, where they go, that's where the horse wound up being. And the trainer, Silas Brown, comes out and tells them to get off. And then Holmes leaned forward and whispered something in the trainer's ear. He started violently and flushed to the temples. It's a lie, an infernal lie. And then Holmes is like, okay, well, let's go talk about it. And so he has tracked, he's tracked, and then he goes in and talks to Brown. And when they come back out, Brown is like docile.
Exactly.
And then they have
he knows what's up.
Yeah. And they have this little cryptic dialogue here. Oh no, there shall be no mistake. It shall be there. Should I change it first or not? And then Holmes is like, don't.
Oh no, there shall be no mistake. It shall be there.
So,
yes, no, don't.
And what he's talking about, if you didn't catch it the first time, is like, should I change the horse back into, take the paint off so it looks like Silver Blaze again with the white
and the
one leg and the
what is the classic phrase, I can never resist the touch of the dramatic. So this is Holmes looking for a little bit of drama in the reveal. That's why he wants it there. It's just drama.
Yep. And we get this now. He explains to Watson, I saw Silas Brown's boot. That's the square-toed, boot we were looking for. He obviously saw the horse and he started to take it back. And then he realized, what? I've got the horse. My horse is going against. I'll take him. And he figured he was going to hide it. He says, Watson, he knows his only hope of mercy is to produce it safe. Now that he's been caught, we can trust him to bring the horse back.
And, exactly. Once a criminal's been caught, it's like, either we know it, we have proof. You can make it worse for yourself by doubling down, or you could just do what we ask.
But Holmes doesn't want to tell Ross because he doesn't think he'll show mercy in the case. And then he has this little paragraph here. You want to read that? The matter does not rest with Colonel Ross.
Ah, yes. The matter does not rest with Colonel Ross. I follow my own methods and tell as much or as little as I choose. That is the advantage of being an unofficial. I don't know whether you observed it, Watson, but the colonel's manner has been just a trifle cavalier to me. And I'm inclined now to have a little amusement at his expense. Say nothing to him about the horse. As I said, a little touch of the dramatic.
But I also love this. That's the advantage of being unofficial.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's...
I do what I choose. I do whatever I want.
Well, he's not bound by the law to...
I don't have to have people arrested. I don't have to reveal that they've committed crimes, as we've seen in some of the cases.
Yeah, well, I mean, what? I'm not employed by the police to supply their deficiencies. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite lines from Blue Carbuncle. But, I mean, it holds.
And we're told that there's no manuscript available for this story. And... he says he just doesn't like Ross either. He says his manner has just been a trifle cavalier to me. That Holmes doesn't like when people don't, when people behave that way, cavalierly perhaps. And then Holmes says we're going to go back to London by the night train. I was thunderstruck by my friend's words, Watson says. I'm sorry he didn't say what ineffable twaddle. That would have been what ineffable twaddle going back to London. But that's when Holmes tells the colonel and the inspector he's doing, we're going back by the Midnight Express, and the colonel's lips curled in a sneer. The colonel's thinking,
dude,
like, you know.
Was- perturbed.
You don't even know. You can't even solve this. But Sherlock asks for a photograph of Straker before he leaves. And he also says, I have a question which I should like to put to the maid, and asks the maid something, which I forget what it is. What is it? What does he ask the maid? We find out later.
Yeah, let me find that. I have a question for the maid. Let's see. I must be disappointed. A horse will run.
I like to know, like, at what point he's putting these things together. It's about the curried mutton and who.
Yeah, that's right. That's why I was just like, yeah.
Who would know that it was curried mutton?
It's a dish that's strong enough to mask the flavor of the opium. Drug and alcohol counselor, I will acknowledge, it's got a flavor, very distinct, very strong flavor. So curried mutton is one of the few things that is actually strong enough to overpower it and mask it.
The curry, I imagine.
Yes. Well, the mutton too, just because gamey,
I don't know.
Yeah. My husband makes lamb a lot.
Mutton.
Mutton is gamier than lamb. So.
But two more things before he leaves. One huge. But the first thing, a sudden idea occurred to Holmes, and he asks one of the stable lads about the sheep in the paddock and that anything amiss of them of late. And he's like, yeah, three of them have gone lame. Holmes is like, I so solved this. I can't believe how much I solved this. I think pleased. He chuckled. He rubbed his hands together
slam dunk. Yeah, he knows that he slam dunked this case.
He says, a long shot, Watson, a very long shot, said he. Pinching my arm. He's pinching Watson. Like, woo! I mean, he is so excited that he has come up with this. He has solved this case that he can't believe.
In modern day, I would expect him to squee.
Yes.
Squee.
And then, here we go. I'll give you the lead question. Is there any other point to which you would wish to draw my attention?
Ah, to the curious incidents of the dog of the nighttime.
The dog did nothing in the nighttime.
That was the curious incident.
Great line. What a great line. It's no wonder that has continued. It's super clever that, that it's that kind of there was an absence of something, right? And you should have noticed that. Doyle's firing on all cylinders in this story, that the little break he took after Copper Beaches to write some other things, to go to Norway and go skiing and all before he sits down and writes the next batch of stories. He is rested up just enough that he's just, is really on top of his game in telling this story and the plot and all the little details and the clever things like that exist in this story. Well, they go home and then they come back for the Wessex Cup. 4 days later, they come back for the race for the Wessex Cup, which you've raced in. You had a horse in the Wessex Cup.
Hey.
Holmes tells Ross that, Ross is like, I still haven't seen my horse. And he's like, but you'd know him if you saw him, right? Like, just the colonel was angry. Holmes is just fun. Like, I've solved this. You all don't know what's going on, but I do. Apparently, Silver Blaze is still the favorite, even though everybody knows the horse that they've got for Silver Blaze, that's not Silver Blaze.
It's not Silver Blaze.
But it's exactly. Still the favorite for the race. It's not the right coloring, and they have the list of horses here. There's no spider in there. Well, there would be now. So
there's a spider now.
And it's 5-4 against Silver Blaze, 15-5 against Despero. I don't know horse racing stuff, so
odds.
They watch the race. Of course, Silver Blaze wins, but that's not my horse, cried the owner. you know, even though he's won. And well, he says that's not my horse. Then he wins the race, and they all go around to look at the horse together. And he says to him, Holmes says, "You have only to wash his face and his leg in spirits of wine, and you will find that he is the same old Silver Blaze as ever." Monica, what is spirits of wine? Do you know?
Spirits of wine. Actually, this is one of those times that I don't know, but
Brandy! Brandy to the rescue once
again. Oh my God, I am a moron. Brandy!
It's distilled wine.
It's always brandy. Brandy and more brandy.
It's not just for medicine, you know. You can clean your horse with it. So if you just put a little brandy on, and you know, it will you take my breath away, says Colonel Ross. And Holmes just says, he was in the hands of a faker, and I, you know, sent him over. So, you know, you're all set. And then we get this, like, this is like an Abbott, because this is like a Who's on First routine suddenly that happens, right? We'll do this, right? I'll start at the end line. "You would do me a greater still if you could lay your hands on the murderer of John Straker."
"I have done so."
"You have got him? Where is he then?"
"He is here."
"Here? Where?"
"In my company at the present moment."
"I quite recognize that I am under obligations to you, Mr. Holmes, but I must regard that you have just said what you have just said as either a very bad joke or an insult."
"I assure you that I have not associated you with the crime, Colonel. The real murderer is standing immediately behind you."
"The horse!" they both cry.
"The horse!"
But I just like that, you know, "You have got him. Where is he then?" "He is here."
"He's here."
"Here where?" Like, you know, "Who's on first?"
"Behind you."
"What is the name of the player on first base?" You know, so they, you know, it's the horse, and now Holmes reveals all. This is all the stuff that, you know, that he has put together. Well, first he says, wait, there's the bell. I'm going to go bet on the next race.
you're at the track. I mean, and it's kind of funny because there's the bell. There's the long-standing theory that Watson is the one that eventually develops a gambling problem. But look, Holmes can't resist putting a bet on a horse. Okay, there might be a paper in that.
Well, now it's also, but Watson seems to know nothing about horse racing. Did I just read about this or hear somebody talk about this?
Yes, I have an entire presentation about this and paper that's in, actually there's a BSI press book called Upon the Turf. And I wrote an essay dealing with Watson's gambling problem from a clinical perspective.
That's it. Yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating, but I mean, it's all about horse racing, available through the Baker Street Irregulars website through BSI Press. So Upon the Turf, edited by my classmate, Ira.
And so, you know, this quote then from Memories and Adventure from Conan Doyle too, probably, where he owns up to the, I'm reading it out of the
yes, read it out of there.
He confessed that Doyle wrote, "I'd never been a racing man, and yet I'd ventured to write Silver Blaze, in which the mystery depends upon the laws of training and racing. The story is all right, and Holmes may have been at the top of his form, but my ignorance cries aloud to heaven. I read an excellent and very damaging criticism of the story in some sporting paper, written clearly by a man who did know, in which he explained the exact penalties which have come upon everyone concerned if they had acted as I described. Half would have been in jail, and the other half warned off the turf forever.
Yep.
However, I have never been nervous about details, and one must be masterful sometimes."
I love it. I love it. You know, it's kind of like, oh, I got everything wrong. Whoops.
Doesn't matter. So,
it's a good story.
It is, and that's what it is. And Holmes reveals all the details here that, you know, he says, first, any theories which I first had from the newspapers were erroneous. He went thinking that it must have been Fitzroy Simpson, but soon realized it wasn't. And then he, this is when he says, it was the immense significance of the curried mutton, that that's mm-hmm. the first thing that he realized. And then the powdered opium is by no means tasteless. So that's why curried mutton was necessary. But who would have known that the person poisoning him had to know that it was curried mutton? Mm-hmm. So that's what he asked the maid about. And he finds out it's only the husband and wife. Clearly, the husband is the only one with a motive, and he knows the motive because of the receipt. And then he follows that up with the picture of Straker, and he shows it to the milliner, and they're like, "Yeah, that's William Derbyshire." Straker's been leading a double life. He has another woman, family, whatever, in London.
Oh, that scoundrel.
And so this is why he needs to fix the race, so then he can make a bundle. Or he's being paid to do it. We don't know that, do we?
I don't believe we are.
I think he just knows that if he throws the race, he can make a bundle betting against Silver Blaze.
It's sports gambling. That's exactly the motivation for lots of sports teams over the years. So why not in horse racing?
And then before deciding, I had grasped the significance of the silence of the dog. The fact that the dog knows Straker, so it's not going to bark when he comes. And that has to be the dog. It had to be someone who knew, the dog. Mm. So he's fixed it all. He's figured it all out. Villain, scoundrel, cried the colonel. He's so angry. He doesn't get to, he can't punish anybody now.
His anger gets displaced, maybe not quite displaced, but at least he's got a dead body to continue to beat, I guess, when it comes to who's the blame. Silver Blaze killed Straker in self-defense. That's pretty awesome, actually.
And Doyle had said this was in a day with Dr. Conan Doyle piece, and I posted this in the Facebook page. He says in this article, he says, "I thought the opening of the next series of Sherlock Holmes, which is the Silver Blaze story, was of such an unsolvable character that Doyle had positively bet his wife a shilling that she would not guess the true solution of it until she got to the end of the chapter." Can you remember reading for this the first time? And did you? Yeah, it's so hard for people who are really in the Sherlock and have read it so many times to remember.
Yeah, that's the downside. Is that I'm trying to remember back to when I was 11. I'm not old, but I mean that's 31 years ago.
I'll put this out there to people in the live chat. Did you guess the ending to this or any parts of it? To put it in the live chat, or just if you're watching the video in general, put it in the comments. I'd love to know if there were people who yes or no, I didn't know at all, or, I thought that it was Straker hurting the horse or something, or the horse must have killed him, so not the Fitzroy Simmons's stick, which I didn't mention, or the Penang lawyer.
Oh, yes, the Penang lawyer.
Which is it's just a weighted stick. It's also is it in later home story? Yeah, we didn't have one yet, but it's in Hound of the Baskervilles, actually.
Yes. But it's a weighted stick, but if I recall correctly, it's actually made from a specific plant that actually grows, and it's got like a knob on the top. Sherlockian and fellow BSI member Denny Dobry, who happens to have probably the best 221B sitting room in America. Sorry, Chuck, this one is off the hook. My friend Chuck Kovacic, who just got his BSI investiture, is also one of the Baker Street builders, people who will recreate the sitting rooms in their houses. Denny's is in Reading, Pennsylvania, and oh man, it is off the hook, amazing. And he periodically at conferences will do a presentation about the Penang lawyer. Mm-hmm. So it's I've learned a little bit about it, and someday I will have it for the Sherlockian collection.
It's the stick that Fitzroy Simmons had, and it is The OED defines it as apparently with jocular reference to the use of the weapon in settling disputes at Penang, which is, you know, in Southeast Asia. But it's also been suggested that the name is a corruption of the Malay Penang Liar, which is the wild areca, which is the wood that they would use to make these. So it could actually be a corruption of just the actual wood that sounds like Penang lawyer, you know, that has been used. So, you know, but it seemed like, and it was such a, not quite a red herring, but it was such a, it seemed like the obvious weapon that was used to crush his skull, because this guy had a heavy stick that could have done that. Exactly. And it turns out the horse just kicked him in the head. So,
yeah,
there we go. Well,
I just want to take a look at the bruising, you know, and to see if there was like a horseshoe shape with the bruising.
And then this is the one odd part about this story. I still think it's brilliant. I think it's perfectly, you know, constructed. But at the end, Holmes reveals everything. When I returned to London, I called upon the milliner, and he spends, and the colonel says, "You have explained all but one thing. Where was the horse?" And then Holmes just says, "It bolted and it was cared for by one of your neighbors. We'll have a little amnesty in that direction, I think." And then, "Oh, let's get off. And you, if you care to smoke a cigar in our rooms, Colonel, I shall be happy to give you any other details which might interest you." I thought it was odd that now he's friendly to Colonel Ross.
I think maybe. I mean, I agree, you know, that it's odd, but I'm thinking maybe, okay, he's had his little bit of fun. You know, Ross is now worshiping at the altar of the brilliant Sherlock Holmes. So maybe, you know, now that Ross is no longer acting like, a jerk, you know, that maybe Holmes is like, yeah, maybe we'll entertain this fella because he's worshiping at my altar.
I think he's so happy with himself. He's so, like, overjoyed that he has been able to do this. He may also have won a couple dollars on the other races, so who knows? Maybe.
Perhaps.
He's got some inside info going on now, too. Like, Holmes is, you know.
Well, yeah, if he bet on Silver Blaze, which one should hope, you know, I'm sure he made a bundle.
Yeah, and, you know, but he also wanted to see the other races, so he might have been betting on them, too. But I'm assuming he's so overjoyed that he's been able to find the little seemingly insignificant details and put it together, and he's all happy with himself. That's what he's overjoyed. Even like Colonel Ross is going to come and have a cigar with him.
Yes, let's sit down and smoke. Actually, Ed, why don't we do that sometime in April in Philly?
We will. I thought about smoking a cigar, but switching from the pipe to the cigar. But I just figured I'm gonna stay with my pipe tonight, which I like.
Fair point.
Well, these are two great stories in a row: Copper Beaches and Silver Blaze.
I love these. I mean,
tremendous that, you know, that we get these, you know, two excellent stories in a row. I'm looking at the chat to see if anybody. No, nobody like quite said, "Oh, I figured it out." They could have lied. They said, "Of course I did. I knew it was the horse, and I knew."
I appreciate the honesty. The Sherlockians in general are pretty darn honest people. If they got it, they'll admit it. If they didn't get it, they will also admit it.
I did. First time I read it, knew it all. No, I didn't. I don't remember. I don't think I did it. I'm sure I was in the dark.
I will take ownership. I was clever, but I was not that clever.
Here's a question for you. Do you read mysteries in general or watch mystery movies and try to figure it out as you go along?
Oh, yeah. The answer, I mean, if it's fair play, then of course, yes. There are times that when it comes to like mystery movies and such, there are times that just kind of based on, you know, some contextual clues. I actually, the movie Kiss the Girls, I had not read that, I hadn't read the book that it's based on, but I was able to, in the middle of the opening credits, figure out who the villain was. I was very pleased with myself when I saw that. That was 16-year-old me in '97, and I'm still holding on to that little victory there. But yeah, I mean, I definitely try to figure things out. And sometimes I get close, but not exact. And it's really satisfying when it happens.
I mean, I don't know if it's like compensating because I can't. I purposefully do not. I honestly don't want to figure it out because I want to get surprised and I want to get the big reveal. So I try not to think about it. So that said, if I do figure out a mystery early on, it's totally the creator's fault. Like they made it too obvious. So I try not to figure them out because I like the big reveal at the end. Yeah. I want to be surprised. I want to be wowed by the figuring out thing. But I don't encounter many people like that. Almost everybody I know does approach this genre as a puzzle. And
I also appreciate the surprise. And I mean, it kind of depends on the context. But, I'm a therapist. And so part of my job is like solving puzzles. And
you're
so
trained.
It's really hard to turn that off.
Yeah.
You know, when somebody presents me with something of, oh, what might that be? What's going on here? I mean, it's just the natural curiosity that I have. Mm-hmm. So, but I do appreciate that whole concept of just letting it wash over you and just enjoying the ride and enjoying the surprise.
Well, Sherlockians, thank you for joining us for episode 17 of Sherlock Mondays. I hope some of you are also wearing your Deerstalkers or your Gorin, what your cap there?
Gorin
Brothers?
Yeah, Gorin Brothers.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Monica, thank you for joining me for this one. You will return for episode 22, a whole month away, but you'll return for episode 22 for the Musgrave Ritual. That will be
North by 10 and by 10.
Yep.
Yes, I will have to regale you with my very famous flub during the Sons of the Copper Beaches. Yeah.
You have to recite that to become a master copper beadsmith. To become an apprentice.
Journeyman.
Journeyman. Thank
journeyman.
You.
Journeyman.
I should know.
recorder, keeper of records.
So. I've got my, thing back here behind me. And anyway, everyone, our next show, episode 18, Curtis Armstrong will join me to talk about a story so gruesome that Conan Doyle cut it from the first British collection, The Adventure of the Cardboard Box. But of course, he included it in the American edition.
I love this, and my investiture in one of the Sherlock Holmes societies, it's called 140 Varieties of Tobacco Ash. My investiture is a half-pound box of honeydew tobacco. And you'll understand exactly why that's disturbing.
There you go,
I'll
explain why it's disturbing that someone actually made a honeydew.
Oh, I know. I need this.
Like of all the tobaccos to make. But anyway, don't let the mundane title fool you, cardboard box. This is a grim story, but really, really well done. Thanks to our chat, Mrs. Hudson, Brianna, for managing the live chat links. Thank you to the sponsor of Sherlock Mondays, Lisa Washington. We couldn't do these shows without the generous support of our patrons. You can support the Rosenbach through donation. Your support helps us create more programs like this and also care for our collections. You can also become a member. Membership gives you early access and discounts to programs and courses. You can find out more at our website, rosenbach.org. Let me remind you again, if you haven't already done it, to subscribe to our YouTube channel, to like these videos. And if you're listening to the audio podcast, leave us a review. Monica, until next time, farewell. Great to see you.
Much love, Ed. Good to see you, and we'll see you in a month.
Everyone, I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenbach Museum and Library, where the game is a book. Bye-bye, everyone.
The Rosenbach Museum and Library thanks you for listening to Sherlock Mondays, sponsored by Lisa Washington, hosted by Edward G. Pettit, music by Pleated Gazelle.